You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and we hope that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. And what you're about to listen to is a conversation I had with my good friend, Justin Morton. And Justin is not only my friend, he is also a professional smart person. He is a philosophy professor at UC Davis, which makes this quote extra ironic. Listen to what C.S. Lewis says. He says, "Friendship is unnecessary, like philosophy, like art, like the universe itself. It has no survival value. Rather, it is one of those things which give value to survival." So, this is a conversation between friends, unnecessary, about things like philosophy, unnecessary. And yet, I hope you'll feel exactly how I felt after having this conversation, full of life, full of joy, even if perhaps there's still more questions to ask. So, we cover a lot of ground in this conversation. What is the good life? How does one find their calling? What does it look like for the church to interact with culture at large? How do we make sense of a good God who lets bad things happen? But before we get to the conversation, a little bit of housekeeping. I'm sure you see the end of the year fast approaching, and I wanted to let you know about a few things coming up. First things first is that FBC is having its Senior Sunday service. And so if you tune into that, you will be seeing the seniors celebrated, and you'll hear Kyle Jung playing some tunes. And also, I'm glad to say that we're finally reclaiming Tuesday night, June 2nd. We will cap the year with a Zoom version of our annual year-end open mic night. So fear not, there will be one more College Life Tuesday night before the end of the year. More details to come about that. And those of you who know Justin Morton are itching for me to stop talking so you can finally hear him. And those of you who don't know him yet are in for a real treat. As you'll hear, he is wise like an academic, he is thoughtful like a pastor, and he's witty like a comedian. He was essentially made in a laboratory to be the perfect conversation partner. But don't take my word for it. Listen for yourself. Enjoy the philosophizing. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Your Pod and Your Staff. You are probably expecting me to be talking with Stanford Gibson and Miriam Hamilton, but not this week. They're taking a break, going back to the bench. And this week, I am having a conversation with my buddy, Justin Morton.
Hey, hey.
We're about to start pretty sentimental. Are you okay with that?
Let's go.
Okay. So I remember when you came to FBC, we hung out a few times and you would come to College Life a few times. And after College Life, we would just chat about stuff. And I remember after one of those nights, I went home and I told Katie, I was like, I think I just made a new friend.
Oh, yeah. I felt the same way. And it's true. It's so weird to make friends after what? 25?
Yeah, right.
I know this is going to sound like Zebby Downer to college students listening, but like, you don't make friends as often after college. Part of your job in college is just hang out with people.
Yeah, hang out with people, make some friends, learn something. Yeah. And then, yeah, find your wedding party. You want there to be at least some people up there with you when you get there. Right. That's your job.
But yeah, so it gets rarer and rarer, but I felt like it was amazing too. I felt like I made a new friend.
Here's the other thing that's a little bit more the depths of my own self-interestedness. I don't think you know this. I've used you blatantly as a way to bolster my own perceived intelligence. Okay? Because what people don't know about you, potentially, is that you are not just my friend, but the reason you came into town at all was because you were working for UC Davis, like a legitimate, no kidding, no jokes, UC Davis professor in the philosophy department.
Yeah.
And so often, I'll be at soirees, dinner parties, gatherings of some sort, and I will sort of maybe want to position myself in a way that makes me seem a little more impressive. And I might say something like, one of my buddies, he's a philosophy professor at UC Davis, and then I'll state what I was going to state, and it makes it sound like what I was going to say has some more credibility. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess you should call that intelligence laundering? You run your claim through somebody else's so that it cleans it up a little bit.
That's right. So I don't know what I'm offering you in this friendship, but you should know that you're offering me something quite juicy.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah. And, you know, last week on the podcast, we mentioned office hours and how ridiculous it is for people not to go to office hours because you have this expert in a field ready to talk to you and ready to answer any of your questions. And so I'm like, dude, we should do office hours with a professor at UC Davis. And so I was thinking that we could have a conversation that felt a little bit like office hours, a chance for me to pose some questions, just to hear your story a little bit through the intellectual journey that you've been on. And it's like to be a Christian philosophy guy in a secular department. So there's all sorts of stuff that you and I talk about a lot, but I thought maybe we should just turn some microphones on and see if it could be useful, a blessing to the college students and whoever else happens to be listening.
Sounds good. One thing I've noticed in quarantine is that the normal divide between my private persona and my public persona has totally fallen apart because the public doesn't exist anymore, right? I mean, like everything is just in my house. So hopefully I won't talk exactly like I would in the confines of my house.
This is one of those things that could sound like an insult, and I hope it doesn't, but it's been so refreshing talking to you because I think sometimes when I'm talking to an academic, not that I do it a lot, that wasn't me trying to bolster my own intellectual credibility, but you're aware that you're talking to an academic, you know, and so you start to kind of watch your words more carefully. You don't want to sound dumb, but I feel comfortable sounding dumb around you. Like there's something about your...
Because I sound dumb so much.
Yeah, I've just gotten used to it, is what it is. But...
I'm going to say it for you so you don't have to. I think I sound dumb sometimes.
I think there's something disarming about talking to you because, you know, you've done the schooling, you've thought the thoughts, you've gotten the degrees, and you have the letters behind your name. But there's something very human about the conversations we can have. And I think that's why it's been so fun to get to know you. So I hope that we can communicate a little bit of that in this conversation to the peoples.
Good.
I thought it would be kind of fun to just get a little bit of your story of how did you get here. If you can hear a little bit of twang in your voice, you are not from California.
That's right.
I'm going to try to remember your hometown. I think it's Nacogdoches or Nacogdoches?
You're almost there. It's a ch instead of a sh.
Nacogdoches. And that's in Texas.
That's in East Texas, yes.
That's in East Texas.
Deep East Texas. Almost in Louisiana.
And so how did you get to UC Davis?
Yeah, well, it's been a wild ride. So I grew up in small town East Texas, like 30,000 people. I freaking love it. Very different from Northern California. Went to a little, I'll say it in Texas terms, it's a 2A school, which means it's like rural school through ninth grade, and then transferred into the big city in 10th grade, which was, you know, the 30,000 person town. And
you didn't go from 30,000 person town to the big city. The 30,000 person town was the big city.
That is a big city. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
So anyway, then in high school, I think in retrospect, it's kind of easy to see the storyline starting. I was kind of a smart aleck, which really contributes to being a philosopher, I think. And maybe I'll just tell one story that kind of says something about where it started. I remember I had this classmate, I can't even remember the class, but we were talking and she was sort of like a skeptical type. And I don't even know how we got on the topic, but we got on the topic of ethics and like the good life. And she said, why should you try to be a good person? And I was so dumbfounded by the question. I was like,
by even the premise?
Yeah, I was just like, what? I mean, it's not that I didn't think it was a good question. It's just that I'd never considered it before.
Sure.
And I blurted out, because the Bible says so. And like, she didn't believe the Bible, so it didn't matter to her. But like, I kind of just panicked when she asked the question because I was like, I've never thought about this before. What's the answer to this?
Yeah.
And I guess you could think of the whole trajectory of, you know, where I've been since then as sort of trying to get a better answer to that question. Not that I don't think there's any truth to that answer, but it's just a kind of unsatisfying answer. For one thing, the Bible doesn't say be a good person.
I was going to say, yeah, show me the verse.
I mean, that's what Jesus said, right? Like, just be a good person and everything will work out. Anyway, so then I went through a period in high school where I didn't think I was going to go to college. I, for a little while, felt super called to be a missionary.
Did you have like big thoughts of like, no matter what I do, I want to do something important?
I don't think so. I don't think I was thinking very much at all. Like, I wasn't thinking ahead.
Yeah.
I don't think I applied to college until like March of my senior year of high school. I just hadn't thought about it very much. And I ended up going to the one I went to because I got an academic scholarship there. Otherwise, I don't know how it would have worked. And I went to Stephen F. Austin State, which is just a little regional university in East Texas.
Hey, little regional university in East Texas that took down the mighty Blue Devils.
That's correct.
Of Duke.
Number
this
one.
Last year.
Dude.
Right? And right when it happened, when I saw it, I texted you. To see if.
I think I had like three or four different people text me. So then I majored in philosophy there. I think I like some why? Point why? I think I just kind of realized that I was gravitating towards those questions. And there's probably also a lot of vanity to it. I was like, oh man, I'm a deep person. I'm going to like do the deep thing. So I think in high school, I had this mentor. We just sort of started talking about this stuff, started out like questions about the Bible and reading Romans and talking about predestination. And I would talk about whenever I had a summer reading list in high school, I would talk to him about the books. And it just kind of gradually organically developed over time that I was drawn to these sorts of philosophical questions. And I wasn't thinking at all about what I wanted to do after college. So that's another reason that I majored in philosophy. An essential enabling condition. Yeah, then I did a master's at Texas Tech and I had started my PhD at the University of Wisconsin. And then I had to transfer midway through to the University of Texas. And then after that, graduated in 2018 and came out here.
It's interesting because I feel like for some reason, there's been a few philosophy PhDs that have gone through FBC. From what I gather, it's really hard out there. There's a lot of very qualified people for not a ton of great jobs. Because that's the reality, you should really want to do it if you're going to go down that path because it's probably going to be a hard path. But it sounds like you didn't necessarily have real clear sense of this is why I'm doing this. Was it just sort of, I'm going to take the next step because I don't quite know what else is there?
I think it at least started out like that, if I'm being totally honest. Sort of just like, I don't know what else I would do and I really like this. But I don't think the part of my brain grew that thinks about the future until I was like 24, like my beard. I also didn't get a beard until I was like 20. No, I was probably like 26, but like,
it's looking good right now.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It's been a hard fought battle. I mean, eventually I got really attached to it and it's kind of been a struggle over 6 or 8 years or so trying to figure out how to think about divine calling. Because on the one hand, there has never been a moment in which I thought, oh my God, I'm literally hearing God call me to be a philosophy professor. Right. Like, that never happened.
Yeah.
And I gather it doesn't happen for a lot of people who still think that they've been called to something. And on the other hand, the few times I've contemplated stopping doing this, I think, well, gosh, I feel like I'm really good at this and I've been able to do a lot of good things for the kingdom.
Right.
And weirdly, like, doors have been opened. Like, let's be honest, I should have never gotten this job. Like, how did I get here? This is a top 50 PhD program in philosophy. It's incredibly prestigious. And I'm like, just some bumpkin. But like, look at the data here. Like, how did I get to where I am? I went to this horrible public high school that it's amazing I learned anything at.
Yeah.
I went to this little regional state school. And here's the thing. Let me tell you a secret, Peter. I'm not smart. Like, I'm not that smart. But somehow I've made it. So on the second hand, this is still on the other hand, I think, God, what explains all of that?
Right.
And that from that perspective, it seems like, well, maybe God has really wanted me to do this. I don't know.
Yeah. Last year, we did a series on the will of God. I think that's a question that our students are asking a lot is, what does God want me to do with my life? Maybe who does God want me to marry? And I think it feels very hard because it's like, if there is a right answer, that means there's a ton of wrong answers. And so, but we do have this idea of like, you're supposed to find your calling. You're supposed to find that which you want, that God wants you to do.
Yeah.
And one of the metaphors we were sort of working with is that it feels like what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to find the yellow brick road. And then once you find the yellow brick road, you just follow it. And so it's easy. All you have to do is be faithful enough to find it. And then once you do, just keep walking.
Yeah.
And it's just such a challenging story to live into because it can be so hard to know what the actual calling is. Because I think so few people do hear a booming voice from heaven say, you are a grocer or you are going to be a CPA, you know? And so we were like, okay, what's a better image? And we said the moving staircases of Hogwarts is a better image because like they can go all sorts of different directions. You just sort of have to take the next faithful step. You know, you don't have to necessarily even know where it's going to go. But if you have reason to think, hey, I might be good at this, I'm interested in it, then it's okay to take that next step without knowing the final destination of the journey. You know, you don't have to think, I want to be a philosophy professor to do your master's in philosophy. But you probably should be interested in thinking like, oh, I sort of like thinking these ideas. I tend to be somewhat good at it. Some people in my life have affirmed that I might be pretty good at this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I really like hearing you say that. That wasn't just like a perfect carved out path for you that you just followed, but that there was some uncertainty and there was some thoughts of, is this the right thing? Is this not the right thing? And then it wasn't even until you got further down the road where you're like, actually, I can see it more now.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was really wrestling with this last year a lot. And one of the passages that really was speaking to me And then I really think God put in front of me for a variety of reasons was the parable of the talents.
Yeah.
One of the things that we skip over in the parable of the talents that's easy to miss is that...
Can you give a real quick, just for people who might not be familiar with...
Three dudes. They have a master who leaves them with some talents, which is gold, right?
Yeah, it's some sort of currency, I feel like.
Yeah. We should not translate it as talent in English, right?
That should be a rule. When it's like there's something that like is just going to confuse us,
yeah.
We should just come up with a new word.
Right. So anyway, he leaves them with various amounts of gold. And one of them has a lot and one of them has some and one of them has a little bit. And he leaves for a few years or whatever. And he comes back and he says, okay, you with the lot, what did you do? And he says, hey, I went and invested it over here and I've got you twice as much as you left me. And then says the next guy, okay, what'd you do? And he says, I did this thing and now I've got twice as much as you left me. And he goes to the last guy and he says, what did you do? And he said, well, I knew that you were a hard and severe master. And so I went and buried your gold and here it is.
Right.
And then the master says, you wicked servant, you know, I can't remember what he says. He condemns
him. He was not pleased.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very displeased. So one thing that I learned in kind of studying this passage is whose perspective are we learning that this is a hard and severe master from?
Uh-huh.
Well, the story doesn't say, hey, by the way, this is a hard and severe master.
Right.
It tells us, oh, this guy thinks that the master is hard and severe, right? I think one of the purposes of the parable is to show you like, oh, when you don't conceive of God as a generous, compassionate, and merciful God, and you think of him in these terms as being hard and severe, and you're afraid, then you've got the wrong mindset about God. And it's going to lead you to do the wrong things with what you've been given.
Yeah.
Because the story never says this is a hard and severe master. It says this guy thinks that the master is hard and severe. One of the things to take from that story is, we need to think of God as a generous, compassionate, merciful God. And I think another thing to take from the story is they weren't operating on explicit directions about what to do with the gold.
So right.
It was sort of like they were brought into the creative activity of figuring out the best thing to do with what they'd been given.
Yeah.
And when you go back and show, like, look at, you know, the Genesis narrative, the first few chapters of Genesis, I think this is exactly what the good life is for humans, is that like God is trying to call us into his creative endeavors and not just as people who follow orders, but people who go out there and figure out for themselves what's needed and what to do about it.
Yeah, yeah. They're called to care for the land and cultivate the land. And I mean, we don't get the actual instructions of how to do that.
Right.
You know, we don't see that in the Genesis account. It's like, you've been given this task. That's my will for you.
Yeah.
But how you do it, I mean, that's the part of the fun.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
That's a thought that has been really comforting to me. At least if you come from certain backgrounds in the church, you can kind of feel like you're not doing things right if you don't hear God telling you exactly what to do at all times.
Yeah.
But that was never the vision, right? I mean, that was, that's on the first page of the Bible, you know? He didn't say, Adam, name this animal this and that animal that. He said, hey, you know, figure it out. You
know? Yeah. Well, and the thing that would freak me out about this kind of God's will stuff, which I don't even, this is great we're talking about it. This was not on the plan, but I had the sense that people thought there was like a couple things that like you definitely needed to hear God's voice about. You needed to hear God's voice about your career or maybe where to go to college, you know, for the people in this age group, like what you do with your life, who you marry, any big transition or change. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, okay, well, if God has that specific of instruction, how do we know that that's sort of the imaginary line as to where his specific instructions start and stop? Like if there is a right way and then everything else is the wrong way, then why is there not like a right way to eat a sandwich? Or like, why is there not like a right thing to have for breakfast? Like, why does it sort of stop at this arbitrary level of like, quote unquote, importance? If there is a, this is God's way for me to live and this is the exact path I have to take, then there's so many different decisions that we're making all the time that should be knocking us off course, which just feels wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And it's weird that we focus so much of our worrying about this on the career option. That's just a super like middle-class Western 21st century thing to do.
Right.
Before 40 or 50 years ago, people worked jobs to make money. It wasn't like their life calling, you know, they had to do what they loved doing and otherwise their life was meaningless.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, even though Stafford's not on this podcast, you can't escape him. But one of the things I remember him saying in that series was that God cares more about who you're becoming than what you do. God's will is for you to become a certain kind of person, not necessarily usually that you have a particular job. Okay. So you mentioned that there was this question that this girl asked you in high school of like, why be a good person? Have there been any other like questions, ideas, hopes, thoughts, dreams that have been somewhat consistent through your journey or that have felt like, yeah, maybe this is why I'm doing this kind of thing?
I can say that there are a few questions that go back really early to like early in this whole process. Although I don't think there's really any that go back all the way to the beginning. I mean, at the beginning, sure. Like I said, I think it was really, just to be totally honest, I think it was a bunch of posturing on my part. My whole time in college was just me trying to look like a smart person.
Yeah.
But then eventually, you know, by the time I got to Texas Tech, I think I can trace this consistent arc from then till now, which is kind of an obsession with the question of what it is to live a good life. Mm-hmm. I don't even call it an obsession. I just think like, yeah, I'm just really, really concerned to figure that out. I mean, there's just such different answers to that. One thing that happens when you enter a profession, I think, and especially when you go to grad school, when a Christian goes to grad school, I'm so reluctant to advise Christians to go to grad school now, because like, I think they just have to get over this hump where they're so ready to buy into the prevailing standards of the discipline. Yeah. That they end up selling out a lot of their Christianity. I think that happened to me for a little bit. Like I stayed a Christian, but you have to think in the grooves that the profession has developed, right? And in philosophy, at least, you know, those are not explicitly Christian grooves, right?
Yeah.
But then I think eventually I've come around and kind of later, like only in maybe the past few years, I've become really interested in figuring out what is the vision of the good life that were presented in the biblical narrative, right? Uh-huh. I mean, I think I had this two worlds mentality. This is a problem that a lot of Christians in the 20th century in America have had in 21st century. It's like separating the two worlds of your faith and, you know, your normal public life, right?
Right.
And I think this is just a very popular kind of background mindset that people have. It's like, look, I'll do my faith over here and I'll do my public life over here. And to the extent that they intermix, it's, well, I'll bring my faith and witness in my public life. Right.
Sure.
It's not that like your faith actually informs how you go about living your normal day-to-day life. It's just that you tell people about Jesus or something.
Right.
But anyway, I think I was doing something similar then where it was like, well, I've got my faith and then I've got these big questions that I'm thinking about, but it just didn't mesh until a few years ago, probably, where I'm like, oh, the question of what a good life is one of the central questions of the Bible. It's in the first three chapters of Genesis.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm still working it out. But like, I mean, look, Genesis is telling us what a good human life is, right? The humans were created to be gardeners, right? And that's the metaphor.
Awesome.
Right? Yeah. But like, you're created to bring order to disorder. That's what a human is.
And you are an ethicist.
Yeah.
Specifically, philosopher, a general term.
Yeah. I'm a specificist.
Oh, a what?
I'm a specificist.
Is that a real thing?
No.
Okay. Well, I didn't know. I didn't want to sound dumb. So the question of what is a good life, that's at the heart of ethics.
So that's the funny thing is that like even the core questions are disputed, right?
Yeah.
What is the good life is a question that Aristotle asked, and he thought that was the central question, and Aquinas after him, and that's informed a lot of the Catholic thinking on this. But lately people have come to think that like ethics is really about what are the right and wrong actions.
Right.
And, you know, people who think that Aristotle's way of doing ethics and Jesus's way of doing ethics think that those sorts of questions, well, that those sorts of approaches, just what is the right way of acting, what is the wrong way of acting, are more superficial.
Okay.
Like, certainly we should ask, you know, is drone warfare wrong?
Right.
Right. Is the death penalty morally permissible? Is abortion wrong? Yeah, those are great questions. But I think people who take this older approach, this Aristotle approach, this Jesus approach, think, no, the bigger questions are about what kind of person you should be. What are the virtues, right? What are the character traits you should have? And then the questions about right and wrong kind of come out of that.
Yeah.
Right. Those are the more superficial questions.
So would you say to someone who is more concerned just about what's right and wrong, well, to what aim, like to what end? How would you ever know what's right or wrong if you don't know what the goal is? Or is the right or wrong just right or wrong, whether or not it's connected to a good life?
Maybe the latter. Yeah. What Aristotle would say is like, look, you can talk. So Peter Singer is this really horrible person.
well, I hope he's not listening.
Don't ever. Yeah. Don't ever let anybody tell you anything different. Anyway, he's this famous philosopher, and he argues, on the one hand, he has the most read essay of any essay in college.
Wow.
in colleges across America. It's the most read essay, I think. It's called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And he argues there that we have a duty to give much more to charity than we currently do. Now, that's not why he's a horrible person.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a good guy so far.
Yeah, I know, right? He also thinks that it's morally permissible to kill children. So that's why he's a horrible person. Because he endorses this view, utilitarianism, that just says maximize overall happiness. And it turns out if you endorse this morally heinous view, you have to think that it's okay to kill children up to like 1 or 2 years old or something.
Why? Because they're like not.
It's something like, well, they're not rational yet. Yeah. They don't have whatever. I mean, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess. Anyway.
Gotcha.
It's wild. And it's wild to be in a profession where that's not only tolerated, but that's one of the leading lights in the field.
Yeah.
So what I was going to say, I think I got rabbit trailed by myself there. But yeah, you could say like Aristotle would look at someone like Peter Singer, who's thinking all about, well, is it morally obligatory to give this much of your income to charity, or is it permissible not to do that? And he'd say, look, I mean, that's a good question, but like, let's talk instead about the virtue of generosity. Mm-hmm. Virtues are such that like they govern more than just your actions, right? If you're a generous person, you're not just someone who gives to charity willingly, right? I mean, even that description involves more than just your action. You're doing it willingly. So Aristotle says, no, a generous person is someone who really likes giving to charity, who no part of them holds back. Uh-huh. They really love seeing people get helped, even if it's not them doing the helping. And this is the weird part. Your perceptions actually change if you're a truly generous person. You actually are better at picking out people in need. Mm. You see things as you walk down the sidewalk that ungenerous person walking next to you doesn't even see.
Right.
They would just totally pass it by. They've never become sensitive to the sort of things that put someone in need. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he says, look, that's a huge, like, complex character trait. And it's really important to be generous. And yeah, I mean, it's important to figure out what's right and wrong too, but
sure,
like that's going to come out of generosity.
That's interesting. I like that idea of, I guess, virtue over, in my mind, it would be ethics, but that doesn't seem like the right description, but virtue versus action, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you can see this in Jesus. Yeah. I mean, what the famous things he says to the, I can't remember, is it the Pharisees? Where he says, yeah, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery, but hey, you know, it's just as bad to lust.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
Why does it matter if you're not committing adultery that you are lusting, right? Well, it's because who you are and your character is just as important as what you do.
Sure. That's good stuff, man. You got an impressive recall of the scriptures. Want everyone to know there's no notes right now. No notes. It's just... It's just off the top of your head. I am really curious as to what it's been like to be a Christian philosopher. And I will tell you, I actually think this is so fun when I try to replay my limited knowledge of something and to see if it's right. But I have the understanding that Christians in philosophy have not been taken seriously. And then I know of a guy named Alvin Plantinga.
Yeah, there you go.
And he sort of put Christian philosophy back on the map a little bit. Like you could be taken seriously in the academy, but that it's still... It's not a hotbed of Christians. There's mostly the prevailing plausibility structures are probably atheistic.
Either atheistic or what's the word?
Agnostic.
What's the word for like when you just don't care?
Oh. Apathy. Apathistic.
Apathetic. There we go. Yeah.
And so I'm really curious to know what it's been like. And I'll ask that question generally, and then I have a few things that I might want to burrow down into. But
sure. On the one hand, there's only been one or two times where someone to my face told me like, oh my God, you're so stupid. At the same time, I have been flying under the radar hard for like my entire career. And that's basically what everybody does. Like all of my Christian friends in philosophy just don't talk about it publicly. And we have little groups or conferences where we go to where we feel finally okay to talk about God. But then, you know, there are some gems out there. I think UT Austin was better. And I think it's better because there's two big public Christian philosophers who are faculty there.
Huh.
And I think this is just Rob Koons and Dan Bonovac. So
don't know them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're not like, they're not planning.
Yeah.
They're not C.S. Lewis. I think this is maybe a general point about echo chambers and ideological diversity. It just turns out the political and ethical and just worldview polarization we're seeing now is probably a huge part due to social media and not having to look someone in the eye who disagrees with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you get two Christians in your department, everybody else is still going to be a liberal agnostic, but they have to look someone in the eye and realize, oh, this is actually a really smart person who thinks these right. things.
Yeah.
So it must not be that stupid.
Yeah. So what do you think, if you were to put your finger on why your colleagues don't believe in God, what do you think are some prevailing reasons why?
I think, at least for some of them, I think it's real, honest struggling with the problems for theistic belief.
So there's legitimate things that could cause someone to not believe in God.
Yeah,
and
for
it's,
sure.
it's actual struggling with those things.
Yeah. And so I don't want to sell those people short. I've actually met a few philosophers who I deeply respect. I met one guy actually who he was like, I really am trying to believe in God.
Yeah.
I'm going to mass with my wife because she's Catholic.
Yeah.
And I really want to believe it. I feel like it's a good thing. I want it to be true. I want God to exist. And I want Jesus to have died and risen for my behalf. And so I'm trying to believe it. And I'm not there yet. And I was like, holy crap, that's amazing. So there are those people. And then there are some people who are not in that position. They don't want it to be true, but they are kind of honest in that it was, you know, the problem of evil or something that threw them off. And they just can't even start to think about it being true for that reason. But then I think there's a lot of other stuff that even for a lot of the people who would tell you that it was the problem of evil or something like that, I think it's something much less noble in a lot of cases. I think, like I said, I think drawing from certain demographics, coastal liberal elites are just pretty apathetic in general. I mean, you look at really wealthy areas, people, you know, they've got everything they need, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
They have made their lives good in their own eyes, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. I think increasingly the political ramifications of faith and what Christianity has to say about sexual ethics, I don't think that's a reason not to think it's true. I just think it's very distasteful to people, especially people coming from that demographic.
Yeah, there would be a cost to believing. And even if, you know, because there's disagreements on what sexual ethics should be, but even if someone didn't believe as conservative of sexual ethics, even if you adopt the label of Christian in the philosophy department, people will assume a certain thing. And so there would be a cost to belief. So you would have to really want to believe it and think it's true to maintain that, it sounds like. Yeah.
But yeah, I think a part of it too is just, it's a cultural thing at this point. Like when you spent 30 years of your life with the philosophy department as your primary community, which is kind of sad, but like if that's where you're at, then, I mean, it's like people who have grown up in culturally Christian areas where it's like, I just don't even really think about it. You know, it's just, I just do this, you know, and there's even some disdain in there, like, oh, well, you're not a Christian, while still not being able to say why you're a Christian, you know? So it's the same thing on the other side.
Yeah, that's something that I've always been interested in. And in my rudimentary understanding of anything, I categorize this under epistemology. But this idea of like, why do people believe what they believe?
Yeah.
And I do think that Christians or just religious people, a knock against the legitimacy of that belief is that, well, it was culturally given to you. Like you probably wouldn't be a Christian if you weren't born in America at this time and had these sorts of parents. Right. And it's like, yeah, that's true. But you also wouldn't have been a moral relativist if you also weren't born in Berkeley.
That's right.
So it goes both ways.
Yeah.
Then it sort of feels like it's a wash. Okay. It's like, well, if you have been culturally informed, I've been culturally informed. Great. Everyone's been culturally informed. Yeah. Now, what are the ideas?
Now let's figure out what's true. Yeah.
So I guess, have you found it hard to be near these ideas? If you think of just the normal career after college, probably your Christianity will not be the explicit guiding principles of the career you're in. You know, maybe there'll be some overlap or whatever. But you're in a career where it is pretty hostile.
Mm-hmm.
And the plausibility structures, that which most people take for granted in their belief, is that God does not exist and that it might be dangerous potentially to believe in God.
Yeah.
And so has it been hard for you to maintain a faith? You were talking about the tendency or the temptation to just keep it under wraps, which I do think probably after a while you do have these two separate worlds, which that's no longer a robust transformative faith. That's a very compartmentalized faith. So I imagine that just even living into that reality would have some effect. But I'm even just wondering intellectually or spiritually, what has been the impact of living your life in such close proximity to people who don't believe what you believe and really not just don't believe it, but are vigilant, I guess, in their unbelief.
Maybe here's one thing that I learned from this, and we can talk about this later because I have some things to say. One thing it taught me is that there are standards for thinking, principles and worldviews and just sort of assumptions that on their surface are not hostile to theism or Christianity.
Yeah.
But really, like, when you work out their implications and you see where they're coming from and stuff, really are.
Like what?
So ethics, you know, the big debate is between roughly three kinds of theory. So there's the virtue ethics people. Those are the Aristotle people.
Right. That's the one where you're saying the thing that should motivate ethics is the values one should have, not just say what's right or wrong. But yeah.
And then there's the Kantian people, and we won't even get into that. That's crazy. I mean, it's cool, but it's like really complicated.
Yeah.
And then there's these utilitarian types, these, you know, Peter Singer types who think that, well, it's really simple. What you ought to do is always maximize happiness for everyone involved. Right. I can't believe we're still talking about this, honestly. It's just.
But if you just say that once, hey, we're going to maximize happiness. I mean, who's not on board with that? It's like, yeah, absolutely, let's do that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're saying, actually, it sounds real nice, but once you scratch out a little bit, you see it leads you to some horrifying things. And I'm putting words in your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, it entails that people don't have rights, for one thing.
Why?
So let me give you a thought experiment. Suppose you're in a town and some heinous crime has been committed.
Uh-huh.
And you're chief of police or something, say, and you've got to figure out who did the crime, who committed the crime. And you know that if you don't find somebody in the next 3 days, just based on, you know, whatever, sociological data or the past performance of the town or something, there's going to be wild riots and like hundreds of people are going to die.
Okay.
And let's just say you can know that with confidence. And you don't even have to be totally confident. You're just like 90% sure or something. But you also know that you're not going to find the person who did it for whatever reason. Fill in the story however you want. Whatever. Yeah. They like took a rocket to the moon or something. I don't know. Whatever.
But you're sure of it. It's not like they're hanging around the town.
Yeah. But you do realize that you could frame somebody really easily.
Oh.
And, you know, he's a drifter. Nobody cares about him. Nobody's going to miss him. And nobody's going to investigate.
Oh, dang. I see where you're going with this.
So you can put him forward. You can frame him really well, right? You're in charge of stuff. You can figure it out. And let's just assume that you can be confident that the framing will be successful and that no one will investigate. And then everyone will be sated. You can, whatever, hang him or execute him or whatever. I don't know why this is in the Wild West in my mind, but like, it's a thing that it is.
Yeah, a bunch of cowboys.
Yeah. And then everybody's fine and nobody dies except for that guy. If you're a utilitarian, you're like, okay, so like 200 people dying versus one person dying.
Yeah.
So it's an easy choice.
Easy. Not only, it's just math.
Not only does it tell you that you ought to frame the guy, it tells you that it not only should you do it, but it's obvious that you should do it. There shouldn't be a dilemma here. You shouldn't even have to think about it.
And it would still be the same thing if it's like, hey, there's going to be a riot and we're confident that three people are going to die. Like the way that this town riots is that they go and they pick three people and they kill them. And so it still would be better, although not by as drastic of measures, to do this framing.
Yeah, exactly. So the way rights work is they are categorical protections against kinds of treatment. That's what a right is. No matter what, you cannot be treated in this way. If you have a right to free speech, that doesn't mean you can say whatever you want. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. But it doesn't matter if you're exercising your free speech actually makes people worse off. The right has to be protected. If it's a right, if it's a real right, just conceptually speaking, it has to be protected regardless of whether it maximizes happiness. And basically, because of this sort of example, no one has any rights. Because for any given person with any given right, you can imagine a situation where violating the right
would be better for everyone.
Would make everybody happier. Yeah. So nobody has rights.
One thing I wanted to do was some thought experiments. And so
I've got some good ones.
Yeah. Can you lay a few on me?
Okay. I'm glad you asked about this. I wouldn't have initially thought of this one, but after 5 minutes of thinking, I was like, oh my God, that's the one I should do. So this is called the experience machine.
I love it.
So this is supposed to get at what we think is necessary for the good life.
Okay.
So imagine there's a machine called the experience machine. Have you ever seen Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
I haven't. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, Mom. I'm sure there are other movies where this is something similar happens, where you can type into the machine, program it or whatever ahead of time to give you exactly the experience you want for as long as you want. And let's say it like keeps you well fed and hydrated and whatever.
I see. So you're set up to this device that's like giving you all your actual bodily needs, but your mind is in some sort of other fantasy world that you're.
Think The Matrix.
Yeah, I guess The Matrix.
Yeah. So it taps into your brain. And so it's not just like a VR experience, right?
Yeah.
It's like you cannot distinguish it from a real experience, right? It's like seamless.
Yeah.
And you can type in whatever you want. And you can actually type in that you forget that you're in the machine. So it feels just like normal life.
So it's like this world is just totally real to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so presumably you could have a more pleasant, desirable life than you currently have. I'm thinking of like that moment on The Office when Dwight says, he's like, he starts this game, Second Life. He's like, my life is so good. I literally created a second one online so that I could spill over into that.
But it's just identical. He's just like a paper salesman.
That's right. He's a paper salesman in Pennsylvania. Anyway, so one question you can ask about this is like, well, should you get into the experience machine? Would you be living a good life? And the answer seems to be no. Well, what do you think?
Well, I was going to say, it's like, it doesn't seem totally obvious to me that you'd say no.
Oh, really?
Well, just because it's like, if it's true that you would have no knowledge, I see like the ridiculousness of what I'm going to say. But it's like, I can imagine someone being like, hey, if I have no idea what I'm missing, you know, it's like someone on Facebook. It's like, I don't want to have a Facebook because I don't want to see what people are doing.
Yeah.
It could be happening, but it's like, if I don't see it, I don't really care, you know?
Yeah.
But if I do see it, then I'm bummed. And so I'll just not have a Facebook. So in this case, it's like, if I can just be sustained and then have really great experience and not know that I'm doing this sort of questionable thing, then it feels like, hey, it's, if you're just sort of maximizing pleasure, it's like, that seems great. You should do that.
Yeah. If you're maximizing pleasure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So have you seen The Truman Show?
I have seen The Truman Show.
So this is the question essentially in The Truman Show, right? I mean, he's not choosing to go into the Truman Show, but he lives in a artificial world, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's one that is very pleasant for him. All of his desires, minus a few, are met. Like, he can't travel, but whatever. Let's assume that away. But then, like, the point of the movie is he still wants out because he's not in contact with reality.
Yeah.
And he has this choice. Oh, sorry, spoiler alert, right? But the movie ends with he's going out the door at the edge of the world or whatever.
It's so good.
And he's like, well, see you later. I can't. Oh, and if I don't, whatever. He says his
good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
That's right. And so one of the things I think the experience machine points out is part of what we want out of life is actually to be in contact with reality, even if we wouldn't know otherwise, right? Like, even if we can program ourselves to think what we're experiencing is real. Yeah. I think another thing that comes out of it is a good life is more than just pleasure and having your desires fulfilled.
One thing I want to talk about is I'm curious to know, like, you've sort of positioned yourself in a scenario where you have a lot of time with like college students and, you know, you've spent some time with college life students, but also these more secular students in your philosophy classes, which I've attended, by the way. That was super fun to like be in class and not have any pressure of retaining any information, but just,
although you did have to get in on the group work.
That's right. Yeah. Right? You split people in groups. Hey, get groups like two or three. And I just look around like, want to join my group?
Right. Yeah, but you can still pull it off. They were just like, oh yeah, this guy.
I'm curious to know, like, your read on the general prevailing worldview of college students. And there's caveats to this question. Obviously, not everyone's the same.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's differences in belief. Obviously, you can't diagnose every single person. But just like the things that you hear a lot, the things that students sort of take for granted, the things that they assume everyone believes. And I'm just curious to know what your read on that is.
Yeah. So before I say, let me give my own two or three caveats. One, I'm focusing on a lot of negative aspects because maybe I'm a pessimist or maybe I'm just trying to give warnings here. So I've got this long list of things that I think students in general are kind of committed to, at least in the background. But I think that doesn't mean that's the only thing I think is going on at the worldview level for students. I'm just gravitating towards those things because I think they're problems. But two, well, let me make a two-sided coin comment. One, I think Christianity and having a faith insulates you from a lot of this. So I'm not indicting listeners here necessarily. And on the other hand, I think there's a warning in this in that I think a lot of it is creeping into Christianity.
Yeah.
And in ways, like I said earlier, you know, how I didn't realize that a lot of the things I was imbibing from the culture around me were inimical to my faith. And it turns out they were. And then I had to do a lot of work to get rid of them. So kind of a warning, but also like not necessarily an indictment. Here's sort of where I see things going. And this, feel free to like bring me back to the concrete reality because this is going to be intellectualized, I guess. So I think that that part of what's been happening for decades is a denial of legitimate authority is a deep part of people's worldview. They don't recognize that anyone, and I don't even think this is just college students. I think this is just our culture in general now. They don't recognize, or they tend to not recognize any sort of authority, definitely any moral authority higher than themselves. And I don't mean that in a theistic sense even either. I think that there's just a strong resistance to granting authority in the sense of like justified power or advice that someone could give you. I think there's a real strong emphasis on tolerance and inclusivity above all else.
Yeah.
I think interpersonally, people think that there are very few moral constraints on interpersonal interactions that go beyond consent, right? Like, especially with sexual ethics, I think you get the sense that people think the one moral norm that governs these sort of interactions is consent, right?
And I see. So you're saying that we all agree on consent, but everything else is up for grabs.
Everything's fine. If you are fully consenting to it, then everything's fine. It's a very, yeah, like, pretty shallow view of interactions in general, especially sexual interactions, is that, like, there's one thing you can say about any sexual interaction, which is just like, oh, well, it was consented to. We have no more questions to ask, right? And finally, I think in general, people hold a radically subjective view of the good life.
That feels connected to the first one.
Denial of authority. Yeah. Yeah. So I think what people think here is nothing is objectively or universally good for people. There's no universal human good, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I mean, you could just see this everywhere, right? Like just the way people talk, you know, if you, what do you want to do with your life? Well, that's, you know, just figure out what you want, where your heart is going. You just got to figure out like whether that's something that you want to do. You know, should you, any given decision that someone has to make, it's all about like introspection and figuring out what you want and what would make you happy. Think about how uncomfortable you would be getting in front of a crowd of people, the general populace, and saying like, I think that all people should do X. Fill in anything you want for X, right? Yeah. Like, it's not going to go over well.
No. Yeah.
And then add on, it doesn't matter if you want to or not.
Right.
This is good for you. See how you feel.
Yeah. You won't be a very popular person in that town.
Yeah. And so I picked these partially because I think they're things that are that are already in the church to its detriment. I mean, in particular, I mean, just think about this radically subjective view of the good life. Like we were just talking about, like look at the first page of the Bible.
Yeah.
God is giving humans a determinate universal purpose and good.
Yeah.
Like that's deep. Or when you're playing Jenga, that's the bottom little, what are those things called? Jenga blocks?
Yeah, Jenga, sure. Jenga blocks, yeah.
That's on the bottom, you know? You pull that out, it all collapses. There is a universal conception of the human good built into the biblical narrative and the Christian worldview. Yeah. I mean, it's just deep in the culture. You just start talking like this and you don't even realize that you're doing it. I mean, myself included.
Yeah.
It's all about what do you want to do? What do you think would be right? Or we don't want to tell anybody what to do here, right?
Right. Well, so I wonder if I could put it in my own words of like, I'm familiar with the phrase plausibility structures, which I think
that's right.
I say it all the time. I think it was Peter Berger. Anyway, this idea of plausibility structures, meaning that which the majority of people in a given group just naturally think are true.
Mm-hmm.
And if you come into college life, one of the beliefs in the plausibility structure would be that God exists. Like most people in that room, you would assume if you go up to anyone, they're going to sort of think that God exists. And there could be exceptions, but that's the natural assumption of what people are going to believe in that room. But if you go onto the university campus, that fundamental belief is no longer taken for granted. But there are other fundamental beliefs that are taken for granted that are not being consistently evaluated or consistently measured against reality. They're just sort of accepted and then you move on. And I think that the subjective view of the good life and this balking at any moral authority feels very strong. Because even I hear this right now and I'm like, oh my gosh, people are going to listen to this and think we are like kooky. You know, it's like you sense when it's like outside of the plausibility structure.
Yeah.
And I, to put cards on the table, it's like, I don't think that human beings are very good at policing sorts of authorities.
Right,
you know, like
right.
I'm not saying that we should listen to one person, but it's like, if you have a prevailing view that actually there's no one above myself that gets to tell me what to do, it's just what seems right to me, what seems right to the community around me. It doesn't take long to get to the fact like, oh, God actually can't tell me what God wants me to do. Even if I were to see it as distinctive from what I want to do, then you start to say, well, he wouldn't want me to be unhappy.
Right.
Then you maybe start explaining things away of like, that's sort of Old Testament-y. or yeah, things yeah. were different back then.
Right.
Then you start to live into that because your bigger impulse is not to trust an authority. Your bigger impulse is to give yourself in that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying about getting into the church is that if you just imagine like a church is nestled up to a particular culture, it seems like when you get closer to a certain group's plausibility structures, they probably will seem more plausible to you.
Right.
Which is a good thing on some level. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if when the Warriors were playing the Cavs in all those NBA finals, and I just have this thought, like all Cavs fans are stupid and mean and awful. And I go to the Warriors game and everyone else seems to hate those fans too.
Yeah.
Obviously it's just in-group, out-group stuff. It's like, then if I meet some Cavs fans and they're actually nice and they actually, you know, believe something I believe, whatever, it's like that whole way of life becomes a little bit more plausible to me.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine if you are just unknowingly living next to a different plausibility structure, again, a different set of taken for granted beliefs, then it's not totally unlikely to think that some of those will start to creep into your existing plausibility structures.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I don't know if I'm confusing everyone here, but I don't love images of the church of being super wary of culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't seem to be a great place to start to me, yeah. of like, we should just separate. We don't want it to be touched by anyone. We don't want to get infected by culture. But I think it would be totally unwise to think that it can't. And probably at all times, there's some prevailing idea that is not from the scriptures or yeah. is not ultimately what God would want for human beings, but happens to be a particular culture takes for granted. There's yeah. probably always something like that happening. And so it would be super wise to think, what are the prevailing ideas of this culture? And what of those do I kind of want to affirm? And what of those do I want to be a little bit weary of? What of those do I want to totally reject?
Yeah.
You know?
And I'll say too, I think evangelicals have particular reason to be very wary. And here's why. I think the evangelical impulse, and it's a great impulse, is to, it's in the name, right? To evangelize.
Right.
We want to keep our witness in, yeah. you know, churchy terms, and we want to be acceptable to the society around us so that they'll accept us and be open to the gospel. But here's the problem with that. I mean, it very quickly turns into, in layman's terms, selling out, right? Like you're yeah. so wanting to be seen as acceptable in the surrounding culture's eyes that sometimes you end up compromising on core claims of the Bible, especially as, and I think this is happening, American culture is getting further and further from being, you know, amenable to the truths of Christianity, in that it's really not deeply informed by the truths of Christianity, and parts of it are really actively opposed to the truths of Christianity.
Do you think, this is a deeper question, but does that bug you? I feel like sometimes I hear Christians talk about how it's like the country's going downhill and the country's right. no longer Christian. And like, I feel like that doesn't bug me at all. Like, I guess I'm under no assumption that it should be Christian other than yeah. like, I hope that all people are Christians, but like, I don't think America owes the church any sort of like, hey, we promise to keep our Christian values,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Good. I'm glad you're reining me in on a lot of this stuff. I'm just going crazy in my house for 2 months. So yeah, I think that's right. And so I don't mean it in that sort of cadre sort of way, you know, like, oh, get off my lawn. The Christians are being persecuted in America. You know, right. like they're not putting us in death camps or anything. But I mean, post-Christian in the sense of, on a purely neutral sociological plane, America used to be more culturally Christian. Now, I'm not saying that was uh-huh. a good thing. There are obviously tons of bad
yeah,
things.
Yeah, just a reality of what was true. Yeah.
There were bad things about that, actually. There were a lot of people who thought they were Christians
uh-huh.
and who really weren't, and who were therefore not open to the gospel, right?
Right.
And that's still happening in lots of parts of the country that are more still culturally Christian.
Yeah.
So here's a stat. I think millennials are the first generation in America ever to not identify majority as Christian. I think that's right.
Oh, wow. Ever. Yeah.
So they're below 50%, whereas every generation before has at least been 50%. Now, again, don't mean to be the guy, you know, get off my lawn. I'm just saying when that starts to happen, evangelicals need to be more on guard about transforming the gospel to fit the society around them, right?
Yeah,
yeah, there's a balance for sure, right? Like you don't want to be totally walled off. And of course, you don't want to be the guy out there in your socks and sandals with the poster board telling people right. that they're going to hell or whatever. But yeah, there's a danger in your primary objective being agreeable, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your primary objective is to be agreeable to the culture around you, you might get away with it when the culture around you is not a post-Christian culture.
Yeah.
But you're just going to end up hollowing out your church and
yeah.
your doctrine in a world where that's not true.
I feel like I'm such a gray area thinker, you know, so it's like, it's so hard for me to ever say anything like, like, this is how Christians should be thinking about this. Yeah. But if, I think what makes sense is that if it's true that the sociological data is that fewer people are thinking within the bounds of Christianity, then it makes sense that even when new people come into the church with that already existing worldview, they're going to be bringing some of that into the church. And some of that could be good. You know, maybe we'll be loosened up from some things that have been unhelpful in the way we've normally seen things. But there's going to also come some stuff that sounds really good to culture, but is maybe antithetical to the faith. And it just makes sense to know that that's happening. Like, it would it would be super unwise to say we should always just be against culture. And it would be super unwise to say culture is never against us, I guess. And that's terrible language. But And I do think that particularly that idea that we get to say what is right and that no one else can really tell me what's right or wrong. I think that particular idea, because it just downplays any authority that, that God would have in having that role in our life, feels like that's not something we should probably be totally affirming.
That's right. I mean, that's like a very low-key way of saying it too, because, I mean, what's really disturbing about this, I mean, if you read the first three chapters of the Bible, like read the first three pages of the Bible, and you see that this very thing is presented as the very essence of sin. Like, go read the two trees, right? There's the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What is being told in that story? They're not supposed to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And as long as they don't, they can keep eating of the tree of life, right? And they choose to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And, you know, as soon as they do, they're banished, whatever. They can't be in the garden anymore. But what the story is telling us is, the essence of sin is trying to make yourself and your own judgment the standard of good and bad, rather than relying on an authority higher than yourself, that is God. And that story is retold throughout the biblical narrative. You know, eventually it becomes the Torah is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the Israelites are asked, rely on this, don't rely on your own judgment. I mean, what's the famous lean not on your own understanding, right? And eventually, I think, if you follow this narrative, you see that Jesus is presented as the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that we are to rely on as an authority above ourselves and not on our own judgment. So I think this is why it's particularly important to be on guard about, especially because we're Protestant, right? Protestants have this impulse, which if not taken to the extreme can be good, and is certainly a good as a corrective to a lot of the things that were happening in the Catholic Church. But taken to its extreme, what we're saying is, no, there's no authority above me. I get to decide what correct doctrine is. I get to decide how I read the Bible. Not even the scholars can tell me how to read the Bible. I was just talking to my wife, Sarah, about this from our hometown, this church that we go to when we're in town. They were a split off from another, and they split off. It was really acrimonious. It was real nasty how it happened. And then once they split off, it was just like such a freaking stereotypical Protestant story, right? They split off. And then a year later, the worship pastor gets mad because the elders are trying to vet the songs that he chooses, theologically speaking. They want to say, well, just run them past us just so we can make sure that they're theologically sound or whatever. And he's like, that's outrageous. I need to be the one that decides this. I'm making my own church. That's how, like a year after they split off from this other church.
Wow.
That is the parody of Protestantism that Catholics make fun of. It's like, no, I get to decide. So yeah, putting yourself as the highest moral authority and making yourself the end-all be-all of what's good in life and your own happiness and your own judgment even is the essence of sin. That's what sin is.
Yeah. Essentially, sin is this really dark word that even, it's like sometimes you use it, it's like, oh, people are going to totally turn off just because of that. But what you're saying that the Genesis 1 through 3 is saying is that at the core of it, you know, we get caught up on the actual bad activity, quote unquote, you know, like, you know, drinking or sleeping around or whatever. But really the core of it is saying, I know what's right.
Right.
There's no other authority that's going to tell me otherwise. Right. And so when they say, I'm going to eat of the knowledge of good and evil, they're saying, I want to be the one that has the knowledge of good and evil. I don't want God to tell me what's good. I want to say what's good.
Such a wild passage. You could just camp out on that passage for months.
Yeah.
I mean, what's wild about it is that they're tempted to eat of the tree because the serpent tells them, this will make you like God. The irony is they were made in his image. They were already like God.
Yeah, dude, it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's initially a puzzling story because, like, why is it bad?
Why would it be bad to have the knowledge of good and evil?
Doesn't God want us to know right from wrong and good from bad?
Right. Hey, before we go, I do think it'd be cool while you're here. You know, often what we'll do is field questions about stuff. And inevitably, every time, there's something about the problem of evil. If God was really a good God. Why would he let this happen?
Yeah.
Why would he let my grandma die? Or why would he let, or this whole COVID thing? You know, it's like, if God was really a good God, like, why is he letting all these people suffer? Like, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, you mentioned that maybe a lot of your colleagues, they don't have belief in God because of things like that particular problem. Like, we have to have an answer to that. If we really say that God is a good God, we have to have an answer for, like, why is there evil and bad things in this world? If he has the power to get rid of it and he's good enough to do it, why doesn't he just do it? And so I'm curious to know, like, how have you made your peace with that question? Or have you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'll say probably about once every 2 or 3 months, I'm like kept up by the problem of evil. So I think the part of the answer is I'm not totally at peace.
Right.
It's not a problem to brush off.
Yeah.
And it's not even a problem that could even expect a completely satisfying answer to. And I think philosophers who think about the problem of evil and write about it and stuff, they kind of generally recognize this. I think this is the right answer. I think it's rationally compelling. I think it's at least enough to make it okay to continue believing in God. But there's never going to be any solution that's just totally intellectually satisfying, or there's not as of yet. But I mean, for me, I think it's good that we transitioned in this way, because I think, look, you can give these sort of generic philosophical responses, but if you look at the biblical narrative, there's a lot to be said there that's relevant to this problem. And especially in the first few chapters of Genesis, if you really think that God created the world in such a way that part of our purpose and our meaning in life is to expand the limited order God started in the world. We're supposed to finish what God started. I mean,
yeah.
I hope I'm not a total heretic for saying that. I don't think I am. God did not create the world as a finished product, right?
Right.
He gave us this half-done project that we were supposed to finish.
The fancy theological term for that is that it was not necessarily like morally perfect, but it was teleologically perfect, meaning that like it was perfectly set up to reach its desired end. It's
right.
A desired telos, you know, so it was not like in itself how it should be, but it was in itself set up so that it would eventually become what it should be.
But you see, if you take that seriously, then it requires this crucial human input.
Yeah.
And it's not a surprise for the Christian or the Jew who reads, obviously, what we call the Old Testament, to say, someone comes to them and says, oh man, but hey, how can you continue thinking this? There's evil in the world. And they'll say, yeah, that's like on the second page of our scriptures. We're aware of that.
Very aware of that problem. Yeah.
So it's part of the story. I mean, it's to be expected in a world that a God created where we were supposed to finish the ordering process that he started, but we radically failed. So I think bound up with that is the more generic thing here is called the free will response to the problem of evil. And I think it's a very integral part of any response is to realize that our being created free was of such great value to God that he was willing to risk the evil that comes about as a result of it.
Right.
And I mean, I don't think it's a wild thing to say that like in a world where there are no free creatures, there's in a sense, there's really not room for value or the kind of value that exists in our world. I mean, think about a world where there are no free creatures. I don't know what freedom extends to. Are humans the only free, truly morally free creatures? I don't know. But I mean, a lot of the things that are of value and of supreme value depend on free action, right?
Right.
Even things of aesthetic value. I mean, think about great artworks. Think about any given artifact, something created by a human, right?
Yeah, yeah. I know that there's been a response to the problem of evil with like, well, it is a problem, but then an atheist, the atheist would need to explain, like they have a problem of beauty. Like why does beauty exist in this world when it wouldn't necessarily have to, you know, which is sort of compelling. It's like there's this world from a theistic perspective has beauty and chaos and beauty and evil right now mixing it up together.
Yeah.
And sometimes we see more beauty and sometimes we see more evil. Intellectually, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
That if you want something that inherently has risk, then it's probably not going to go perfectly all the time. I think what makes it hard sometimes is that we still are wanting to pray to God as if he can like really do something and show up.
Yeah.
And then it seems like sometimes he does rescue us from evil and sometimes he doesn't rescue us from evil. And that's the kind of thing where I'm like, I feel as a pastor, like I'm wanting to give some sort of explanation for that. And I'm often feeling like, is it just horribly unsatisfying for me to tell you? I just don't know. Like,
So a good rational response to the problem of evil is not going to be a pastorally satisfying response. You know,
when you
go to someone who is dying of cancer at 33, you're not going to say, oh, you know, think about Michelangelo. And he couldn't have painted the things that, I don't know, did Michelangelo paint? I don't know anything.
Oh, yeah, Sistine Chapel, baby. Okay.
He couldn't have made that stuff if it weren't for free will or whatever. And they're going to say, it's not going to be satisfying at all.
Why couldn't Michelangelo have painted without free will? Like, couldn't God have just been, like, told him to paint?
I don't know. That's a good question. Look, we have created painting machines. Like, you can go on Amazon and buy the God person almost fingers thing for $15 probably. And that was just created by a machine. Of course, you could say, well, the only reason the machine can create it is because a person created first and then they're making copies. But yeah, I guess he could have created unfree machines that could just create things that look like that. It's a weird thing. It seems like part of the value is actually not in qualitative aspects of that painting, right? Like, why is his original worth so much when we can create a qualitatively identical version, right? That's worth $15 on Amazon. And I mean, his is on a building or whatever. I don't know, whatever.
Sistine Chapel.
Yeah. I'm amazed it's taken this long for it to come out how stupid I am about anything of cultural value. But like, yeah, it's because we think there was some importance to like the creative act that he engaged in. It wasn't just some mechanical thing. And I don't know how to explain how the creativity works, but it seems like it has something to do with his being free and not determined.
So then to put it like in total layman's terms, it's like there is evil in this world and it's bad news.
Yeah.
And it's not because God's not powerful, and it's not necessarily because God's not good, but it's because what God wants is for human beings to partner with him to bring his goodness, and they consistently say no.
Yeah, that's right.
And they consistently do something else, which then kind of gets back to what we're saying. If, well, I'm not going to do what you want, God, I'm actually going to do what I want, which then opens the door. What happens when what I want is not good for a whole slew of other people?
Yeah.
Now you got evil, you know?
No, it's true. I mean, so I should correct too. I mean, I was just focusing a lot on this painting and aesthetic value. But yeah, you might think that's important, but the really important thing is like moral value. Like our actions wouldn't have moral value without. It actually has kind of changed the way I prayed, like reading the first few chapters of Genesis in this way, where I end up praying for God to give his human agents wisdom to solve this pandemic crisis. Now, I also pray that God miraculously work to directly solve it. But at the same time, when you read Genesis and you see this picture of human purpose and meaning, you start to see, oh, God's goal for the universe and for human beings is not for him to be answering our prayers all the time. It's actually for us to be ordering the world in the way that he orders it. A scientist who takes it as their goal to solve whatever, to create a vaccine for COVID-19, is bringing order to the world the way that Genesis chapters 2 and 3 are envisioning.
So I wonder how that's not like deism. Like, I wonder how that's not just like, okay, God set human beings and now God's going to just let human beings do his work.
Yeah.
Because we certainly don't see that in the scriptures.
That's right.
Like God is involved. God does do stuff.
Yeah.
But I wonder on the whole, if we'd be surprised how often God might say to us, you're my agent. You can go do that. Like, if you think about what he did with the apostles in Acts, like they're doing remarkable stuff that Jesus was doing beforehand. And it seems like that a little bit, it's like, okay, Jesus was here and then he passes the torch of God activity on earth to the church. So yeah, I do think there's that in it. I also think pastorally, the thing that does feel true, and whether or not people want to believe it, it does seem right about the problem of evil, is that we do not have a God who does not know what it's like to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to give you a reason for why bad things are happening to you, but I can offer you a relationship with a God who has suffered badly on earth and knows what it's like and wants to give you his spirit and have a relationship with you.
Yeah.
And so there is that sort of pastoral response, but that still doesn't always curb my desire to know more of, well, why doesn't he stop these things that are horrible? And it seems like bad PR. Regardless, it seems like terrible PR to like feel like, hey, I got all the power and I'm just not going to use it.
Yeah. Like I said, it's never going to be fully satisfying. And ultimately, I think we still have to engage in some substantial trust of God. So yeah, you're right. I think that in giving this sort of response and viewing human meaning and purpose coming from Genesis in this way, you're right. I don't want to go to this extreme that is actually kind of playing into a lot of trends in the church right now of like psychologizing God's action, right? Yeah. All God does, all the gifts of the Spirit, all the Holy Spirit is doing in the world is sort of interacting in our heads with us and giving us motivation. Oh Lord, give me strength. This is sort of a trend in the way that a lot of people think about the Spirit's action. It's kind of a holdover, basically, long story short, from the Enlightenment, is that we don't want to think of God as interacting. It's the deistic trend, right? And this is where a moralistic therapeutic theism comes from. We have this aversion to thinking of God as interacting with substantive ways in the world, and yet somehow we skip over the fact that he raised a freaking person from the dead.
Right.
Like, but yeah, so it does. It creates new questions. It's like, wait, but I think there's just some sort of balance, right? Like, God wants us to be substantively involved, and yes, it is by his power, and certainly we can't do it without him. And at the same time, he's stepping in really serious ways, in miraculous ways. And in addition, it's because we've screwed up so much that he sent his son to finish this process for us, right? And it's by his power that we do what we do.
I don't know if this jives philosophically, but it's like, I often think about, well, what world am I expecting to live in? And what world are the scriptures expecting me to live in?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the world being diagnosed often is this one of tension, of beauty and chaos. So I should expect that the world that I live in to have beauty and chaos within it. And so if I'm seeing no beauty, that'd be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm seeing no chaos, not that it'd be a problem, but it's like that's not what I should be expecting. I think that the Christian faith is one of tensions. There's a tension between grace and truth. There's a tension between Jesus being fully man and fully human. There's these tensions that are not being attempted to be addressed. There's a tension between God being divinely in charge of the world and our agency.
Mm-hmm.
In the scriptures, we are not invited to take a side on that. In the scriptures, we are invited to affirm both those things and that live into the mystery of that, to affirm that God is in control somehow and to affirm that what we do matters.
Yeah.
And it's not like, oh, if you weigh the data, you're going to come to a conclusion. It's like, no, if you weigh the data, you're going to see both of those things.
Yeah.
And you could see that as a bug of the faith, or you could see that as a feature where it's like, we don't know the mysteries of the world. And I understand even saying that, it's like, well, that's a convenient thing to say if you believe in something that has contradictions, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. It doesn't trip me up much. I think it's part of it is because, like, if it's true that this God is way other than, then I would sort of expect there to be some things that I'm not totally able to comprehend.
Yeah.
And I would also expect that a virtue is to be able to be faithful even without knowing all those things, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever read C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy?
I have read the first one.
Oh, man. The first one's great. Second one's great. But the second one is a retelling, in one sense, of the Eden story.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, it's so masterful. But one of the things that he talks about there in the story, you know, Ransom is in this new world on a new planet. And there's this island that the gods of this world have told the beings of this world that they can't go to. And they haven't given a reason. And so he's being tempted in the novel to go to the world and to check out this place that he was told not to go to. And, you know, there's all of, you know, Serpent Eden stuff going on where he's like, you know, he's being reasoned with. Why wouldn't they tell you why you're not supposed to go? Anyway, and it turns out that, like, there was a reason. I mean, I can't even remember what it was. But they didn't tell him the reason because it was good for him to learn to trust without the reason.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I can totally see that. Which does go back to the authority thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, do you trust me because you know that I'm good and will give you what's good?
Yeah.
And are you willing to trust that without knowing everything? But I think that's a good place to park our conversation. But I don't know if you've been listening to the pod, but at the end of every podcast, we do this thing called Quarantine Corner. And what happens on Quarantine Corner is, you know, we're living in strange times and all sorts of different are filling our days and filling our weeks. And so we want to give people some recommendations on what to do to fill their time. And actually, I know for a fact, as we were talking about it beforehand, that you and I had the same, believe it or not, Quarantine Corner. And so we're just going to combine them into one. Cool with you?
That sounds good.
We're about to introduce you to the 10 greatest hours that you could spend in the next week or so. If you've been living under a rock, maybe you don't know this, but there's been this documentary series called The Last Dance, which is about Michael Jordan's last season, the Chicago Bulls, the 1998 season. And Justin sent me a text the other day saying, are you watching this thing? Are you watching this doc? And I was like, dude, it's like my favorite part of the week. My favorite parts of every day are thinking about the pizookie that I'm going to eat that night and a chance of maybe we're going to watch the MJ doc. But what do you love about the MJ doc? Tell me your thoughts.
Here's the crazy thing. Y'all can actually trust me more than you can trust Peter, because I don't actually care all that much about basketball. Like, I'm one of these people where you can maybe twist my arm to watch NBA if a Texas team is in the end, whatever, the finals. So it's really not like this fanboy, like, nostalgia thing for me, although it really is interesting. I was born in 1989. And so when I was in elementary school, I remember seeing all the Jordan jerseys and all. I mean, in East Texas, right? Like, Chicago, who cares about the Chicago Bulls in East Texas? Apparently everybody in 1995. So it's kind of interesting to see how this all developed and how he changed the NBA and made it the thing that it is today. And before that,
totally.
people generally didn't care. But I think what's really interesting to me, and I guess this is not going to be a surprise to anybody who's listened this far into this podcast, is some of the ethical, not ethical, but like ethical in the deeper sense issues going on, in the sense of the virtues and vices that Jordan has and his teammates and the sort of mentality that he had.
Yeah, but I'm so glad you're going this direction. This is where I wanted to go to.
So yeah, so for people who haven't seen it, and I can't even remember what episode this was from, but let me tell one story. This story like really stuck with me. So Jordan, what season was this where he got his foot injury?
Oh, I think it was his second season.
So not a championship season? Oh, that's right. It wasn't.
Yeah.
They got eliminated. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he injures his foot and he's out and they say, you can't play. The doctors say, you can't play at all. And he, first side note, he's secretly playing the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. He's playing pickup games at North Carolina.
Yeah, he goes back to college during this time because they tell him you can't play any basketball. And part of the reason he goes back to North Carolina to go to college is so that he can play games and not get caught by the coaches. So anyway, he comes back to the team and he says, I can't take this anymore. I got to play. And so he's like battling with the coaches. He's like, I'm going to play. And they're like, no, you're not going to play. It's not time yet. The doctor said, you had to wait this long or whatever. So finally they say, okay, well, let's just go to the doctor and see what the doctor has to say. So the doctor tells him, if you play again with this injury, you have a 10% chance of re-injuring the foot.
Yeah.
And if you re-injure it, you will never play basketball again.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, I'm going to play. Anyway, they fight some more and they come to this compromise. You can play for, what was it, 14, 15 minutes?
I think 14 minutes, 7 minutes a half.
7 minutes a half of game time. You cannot play any more than that. And so they come to this agreement and he does this and they are in a must-win scenario, I think, right? In the
playoffs.
And it's like the last 30 seconds of the game and they're like 1 point behind or something. Mm-hmm. And his 14 minutes run out.
That's right.
And he says, I get it, but just let me stay in 30 extra seconds. Mm-hmm. This is a must-win scenario.
I'm the best player.
I have to take the shot. 30 seconds is not going to injure my foot. Mm-hmm. And they say, no, you have to sit on the bench. And he, needless to say, is outraged, just totally, permanently, apparently, spoils his relationship with the people who made the decision. And he actually had this suspicion that they were trying to tank the season to get better draft picks. Because if you do worse, you get better draft picks. And he was so mad because to him, and in his own words, it deeply violated the true spirit of sport and competition, in that it is part of the essence of sport that you have to play to win. And if you're not doing that, you're not playing anymore. And so it was so interesting to me to like have that like deep seated respect and honor for not only just the game of basketball, but sport and competition in general.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I thought was super interesting, I was born in 91. So I caught just the tail end of Jordan's career. I went to a Wizards Warriors game so I could see him when he was on the Wizards. I don't even think he suited up. But so I've grown up with this LeBron character as sort of the challenger to Jordan's greatest player of all time. And I will admit, I was thinking, yeah, LeBron is, he's so good. And anyway, sorry to get so sports heavy, but I do feel like it has a human payoff. So I'm gonna go down this direction for a second. And so I've often wondered, everyone says Jordan's the best, but it's like, is that just sort of like an old guy thing of like, my guy was better than your guy? And that's sort of what I thought, you know? And I keep telling Katie when we're watching this thing, it's like, I had no idea Jordan was that athletic. They always just talk about his will to win. So I was like, oh, he was just like more committed than everyone. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't a bet. He wasn't like what I'm watching in this documentary. But then, man, he is also notoriously a tough teammate. Just would push his teammates as hard as he could push them to get the best out of them. And there's this scene at the end of episode 7, which I thought was the best one of the series. And Jordan is sort of giving this speech about his leadership style of like pushing people and pushing people and pushing people. And he starts to break down.
Yeah.
And he's starting to have this moment of like, he's just like getting very emotional about this particular way that he's done life. And I heard some people talk about this episode because it just made a big deal in like the sports world, and talking about it in terms of LeBron, who doesn't have that same kind of reputation. And they talked about it too. They're like, I wonder if Jordan in that moment was reckoning with the fact that he's given up so much other parts of his life to have this singular goal. And so to me, it's brought on a lot of these thoughts of like ambition. And it's like, yeah, I think after watching this documentary, Jordan's the best player of all time.
Yeah.
I think it's unassailable, right? It doesn't matter for the conversation. But look what he gave up. Like in this doc, his family is never talked about.
Yep.
His wife is there for a second, but they got divorced and he doesn't seem to be that involved with his kids' lives. And I was listening to them. Yeah, when he goes and plays baseball, he's hitting in the batting cages 3 times a day. Doesn't sound like he's spending a lot of time with his kids.
Yeah.
And then you look at LeBron James and he's this family man. you know, and he's got this family very upfront. He's very into his kids' athletic careers, academic careers, and he's very noticeably married. And I've been thinking about, like, which one do I want to be? You know, it's like, sure, maybe we think LeBron is not as good as Jordan, but like, he also has this other part of life. And I don't know, I find myself thinking about it a lot more than I would have expected myself to be thinking about a sports documentary. And I will also say there's just some nice thrills for a sports fan. If you're craving sports and you're not watching this, I don't know what you're doing, because it is incredible. But also, it's got this real human side to it. And so I can't recommend it enough. It's called The Last Dance. Space Jam's involved, which I think is tremendous.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's my quarantine corner. A little more human earnestness than maybe some of mine have been. But I really love that idea of like Jordan is the best, but what did he give up to become that? And do you want to? You know, even if you think about, hey, Peter, what do you want in your career? It's like, do you want to lead a big, 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 huge church and have all this influence? And would you be willing to sacrifice your family for that? Obviously, no. My answer, quick answer, is no. You know, but if you were to say, hey, would you want just a little more influence? Would you want a little bit more of people to think you're pretty cool? And yeah, maybe you just have one less afternoon with your family. You know, it's like, I'm not saying anything's right or wrong in that, but it's like, it starts to paint those value dilemmas that I think are really interesting.
Yeah, and because in one respect, it's super admirable to just have single-minded devotion to something.
Yeah.
And in fact, as the documentary is trying to make clear, excellence, true excellence, especially in a competitive field, requires it. You cannot be truly excellent without having that single-minded devotion. And at the same time, it may not be a good thing overall.
All right, that's it for your pod and your staff. Justin, my man, thank you for your wisdom and your wit and for being my friend. I mean that very, very seriously. And everybody, just for kicks, you can give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. But before we go, I have some exciting news to share. There's been a new member added to the College Life family. Emily Ruff, previously known as Emily Deering, just welcomed the newest little agent of King Jesus into the world, Rhodes David Ruff, and he's spectacular. We love you, Emily. We miss you. And as always, thanks to Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung, who created the music for your pod and your staff. It is grooving. And just a reminder that Senior Sunday is on the 31st, and that College Life will meet again for an open mic night on Tuesday, June 2nd. And finally, dearest College Life, we love you more than Paul Mutz dominates any limbo competition this side of the Mississippi. See you next week.